Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
Doing pretty well, Tim. Getting ready for the holiday. The government-issued holidays, we found out in this interview. How are you?
I am doing well. Yes, the federal holiday is coming up this week. So this episode is holiday-themed, and we're going to dig into what it really means for Thanksgiving.
And I'd like to assume that our listeners know that during the holidays, especially significant holidays, we try to do an episode that is apropos of that holiday, like we did the history of Halloween. We had a Krampus episode one year. This is very Thanksgiving themed as well. We have three filmmakers on, three activists on, who made a short documentary titled Bounty. And the subject matter of this is the proclamation issued by the state of Massachusetts for the bounty that was placed on the scalps of Native American people, issued in November of 1775.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking to learn about all this history. And Lance, we're located in Massachusetts, and part of this documentary, actually the documentary, is filmed at the Old State House in Boston, Massachusetts, where those bounties were signed originally. And that is pretty remarkable to see the reaction of the people being in that room where those death warrants really were signed. And they have children in the film too, in the documentary. And I think it really adds an interesting element to sort of learn these things through the eyes of children.
Absolutely. What a good point, because that's where it starts. And we talk about this in the interview, that it has to start with educating the children, and it has to start with watching the documentary, showing the documentary to children, even this episode, even this interview. And it's important to have children know about this and learn about this sooner rather than later. And we're not saying sit down with your family for the holiday, fire up the podcast interview, and get all serious. We're saying listen to this at your leisure and just take with it what you want.
And in this episode, we are joined by Don Neptune Adams, Adam Mazo, and about 10 minutes into the interview, Mollian Dana joins us. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Hope it expands your thinking about the holiday and what land you're on.
Exactly. It's very thought-provoking, and there's a call to action, if you will, at the end of the episode, which is just recognize the land that you're on, the land that belonged to natives back before you lived on it. And after the interview, I downloaded that app and I learned what territory I live on. And I know for sure I will be bringing that up during the dinner that I have with my family. And we will acknowledge that. And we will have a conversation about how we can properly pay respects to those whose land we are on.
Okay, so check out their website, and you can watch the entire film. It's bountyfilm.org, and they are having a screening, an online screening, on January 20th, 2022, so you can join from wherever you are, and that should be pretty interesting. We talk a little bit about that in the interview as well. So I hope you really like this conversation. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. Follow us on social media at Crawlspace Podcast or Crawlspace Pod on Twitter.
And to learn more about the folks behind Bounty and behind the other documentaries that have been made, you can check out upstanderproject.org. That's upstanderproject.org.
We're going to play a quick word from our sponsor here, and then we'll be right back with Don, Adam, and Mollian.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
We are being joined now by two filmmakers, Dawn Neptune Adams and Adam Mazo. How are you today?
Quay, quay. That means hello in my language.
That's awesome. Okay, so you started the means hello in my language. What is your language? And that was from Dawn.
Yes, that is the Penobscot language. That is the language that was washed out of my mouth with soap when I was a child in foster care. So it's actually a real big triumph for me to be speaking it today.
And I feel like that's a literal that's a literal moment in your life.
Yes.
And you folks got on our radar because these news headlines pop up, these news notifications pop up on our phones and in our emails, where it's topics that we want to discuss on our show. And so we have, like, you know, Google alerts that we set for these types of things. And the headline for this from The Guardian is New England once hunted and killed humans for money. We're descendants, and we are descendants of the survivors. And this is something that was written by you folks in conjunction with your documentary. And also, once you start reading this, you get a heavy, shocking piece of history. Can you give us a little bit of a background on this? Like, where are you from, and what are we about to get into today?
Andalouisi Don Neptune Adams, Nijiao Bunawebskewi, Skishinaweapid, Pakump Dodum. My name is Don Neptune Adams. I am Penobscot from the Fisher Clan. We are about to discuss a film called Bounty, in which three Penobscot families travel to Boston to the Maine State House, where a death warrant for our ancestors was signed. In the film, we read the death warrant and we talk to our children about it.
Very interesting. The film is very powerful. What gave you the idea to make this film?
So I'm Adam Mazo. I'm here in the territory of the Massachusetts people and their neighbors in Nipmuc and Wampanoag Nations, also referred to as Boston these days. I'm Ashkenazi Jewish. So when we talk about the descendants of the people who were scalped, I'm not one of those. I'm a descendant of settlers. Some people would say immigrants, but I feel that part of being a non-native person is part of owning that settler privilege. And even though my literal ancestors, as far as I know, weren't involved in scalping, weren't in these lands at that time, I still take on that identity. I'm a settler, just like many of us who benefit from that settler privilege that many of us have, being on stolen native lands as we are. I am one of the co-directors of the film, along with Don Neptune Adams, Molly and Dana, Ben Pender-Cudlip, and Tracy Rector. And the idea came about as Ben and I were in the production for a film called Dawnland about a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Maine that was investigating the taking of Wabanaki children through the child welfare system. And we filmed many presentations by an organization known as Wabanaki Reach. And they would kind of lay out the history of Passamaquoddy and Wabanaki people, Penobscot people, Maliseet, Mi'kmaq, all of the Wabanaki people. And they would talk about the different ways that colonizers had targeted Wabanaki people over the centuries since they've been here. And one of the things that really caught our attention was what ended up being Bounty, which was the Phipps Bounty Proclamation of 1755 that we focus on in the film. And we heard about it in presentations. And we also saw it on the wall at Penobscot Tribal Nation as a declaration that Penobscot people are still here and that people like me tried to kill Penobscot people under these bounties. And we made the film because we felt like we couldn't find a place to tell this part of the story in Dawnland as much as we wanted to. And so when Dawnland was finished, we thought we need to find a way to tell this story because it's largely unknown. Even in the early stages of the release of the film, we've heard over and over again, oh my God, I didn't know, I had no idea, or I thought that natives did all the scalping. But when the reality is, it was largely settlers doing the scalping. And importantly, the point that we want folks to learn through Bounty and through the teacher's guide is that the settlers monetized it and connected it to taking the land. They came And they said, we're gonna pay people to scalp Native people, human beings, and we're going to do it as a way to take the land from Native people. The land is what became the United States. And so we felt that was an incredibly important story to tell, and initially had the idea of asking Penobscot folks to read the document. And we felt from our experience from Dawnland, it was incredibly important to make sure that we were collaborating with Penobscot people. So not directing Penobscot people, but co-directing with Penobscot people. So we asked Dawn if she would be interested in getting involved with her child and Malian as well. Amazingly, they said yes. And that was a key part of the equation, was doing it together. And along the way, my colleague Michi Lesser noticed at the bottom of the document that it says, signed on this date, November 3rd, 1755, in the Council Chamber, Boston. And so we looked into, where is the Council Chamber? Does it still exist? And it does. It's the old State House right on top of State Street Station in downtown Boston. A very notable and recognizable building for anybody who's walked up and down State Street near those bars and restaurants and Faneuil Hall. And there's very little to no acknowledgement of this history in that room or in that building. And we're hoping that with Bounty that we can change that. That's why we made the film. And we hope that people who walk the Freedom Trail will begin to recognize that freedom wasn't for everyone. At the same time that the revolution was underway, the colonizers were issuing scalp bounty proclamations to scalp Wabanaki people for decades and decades. We know of 69 different scalp bounty proclamations from the mid-1600s to the mid-1700s. It's not just this one. And we know of many, many dozens and dozens of human scalps turned in for money. I see Malian joining, so I'm going to take a pause.
Hi, Malian. How are you today?
Hi, I'm pretty good. How are you? Apologies for being late.
Doing good. No worries. Yeah, thanks for joining.
Okay, so Tim had mentioned before that the documentary was powerful for just under 9 minutes. I think it clocks in just under 9 minutes or around 9 minutes. It does pack a lot of power. And one of those moments that you don't get away from is the fact that you all are shooting it in the State House. And there are so many, and you mentioned this, is an extremely notable building. It's very recognizable. Thousands of people see it every day. And they also run tours through there. And I've done a tour through there with family members and friends. And there's never a mention of that specific room that you're in. There's not a mention of anything anything close to what your documentary is about. How did you get access to shoot in there?
You know, surprisingly, the good news is that the folks at Revolutionary Spaces who are running, oversee the Old State House and the Old South Meeting House, despite not having a lot recognizing the scalp bounty proclamations, they have been quite receptive to trying to shift that. And we are hoping, our organization, Upstander Project, is trying to work with them to get them to install this film in there and to install some of the other videos that we've made around it with Don and Malian and their families, encouraging action beyond just watching the film. And they've been quite receptive. We're still waiting to see exactly what will happen. We are intending to do an in-person premiere of the film in April at the Old South Meeting House. We wanted to do it in the Old State House in the room where we filmed, but it's quite small, which is the only reason we're not doing it in that room, but they were open to us doing that. But we hope to take that opportunity to actually bring people into the room and sit and reframe what went on in there. Typically you go in there and it's kind of like, oh gee, isn't it great that all these English settlers did these wonderful things so that we could all have freedom? But completely omitted from the story is the Penobscot story, the Wabanaki story, the story of Indigenous people, that I'll defer to Malian and Dawn to share more about that.
So I've said before that Indigenous people are not vulnerable. They are targeted, marginalized, and silenced. And a lot of what mainstream American society is taught is whitewashed history. It's American exceptionalism and a very pretty story about how this country came to be. And I think it's really important that the true history is told.
Yeah, I echo that as well. That was a big driving force for me to join into this project and to bring my children in, because, having learned about the Scout Proclamation and this kind of dark history in our community and in the reservation school and my children learning about it, it hit me as I got older in life and went into other parts of Maine and my education that most of the world, Don's exactly right. They learned a very candy coated version of history written by the groups that benefited from the oppression and hunting of our people. So it only makes sense that we would want to shine a light on this. And what's different, I think, now than 20, maybe even 10 years ago, is that we're able to bring a lot of folks along on that journey. And there's a lot less defensiveness and a lot more willingness to tell some dark truths and see, how that relates to our relationships with one another and how we go forward.
Well said to all three of you, and especially that educational aspect to it. My ultimate question to this is going to be, how do we start implementing the education aside from your documentary? This is one way to do it, and I'm assuming Dawnland is something similar as well, where it's acting as something to educate people. It needs to start young, too. I watched the documentary, and I saw the moments where the children are reading the bounties, the amount that's put on the scalps for the Penobscot. And I remember this moment, like I made a comment a few years ago, and my nephew was there, and he was really young, just about like the actual history of Thanksgiving. This was several years ago. And I remember my sister, his mom, making a face like, don't say that. Like, he's going to learn about it in school. And I didn't continue at all because I'm not like his father. So that's not my place. But I just found that it's extremely frustrating when it's just easier to teach the wrong thing because it's more comfortable than teach like the actual truth. My super long-winded point leading to the question is, where do we start with that?
I think you said an important thing when you said we tell things that aren't very true because it's comfortable. And an important thing to think about as we go through all this is that comfortable for whom? Think about the Indigenous people and the other marginalized, targeted people throughout the history of this country and Canada that have had to live with, everyone else spreading lies that make them comfortable when our stories are very invisible and not told and outright ignored a lot. I think a great example is the Thanksgiving myth. Another great example is Walt Disney's Pocahontas. We dress these things up and make them really pretty to look at and make everybody feel good. But at the end of the day, you're making our experience invisible in our own homeland and not telling our true stories. And even if it looks nice and makes people feel good, that's still really harmful because we are, descendants of real people that lived through real things. So it only makes sense that at some point, that comfortable factor is going to shift. And maybe we all have to get to a place where we're more comfortable being uncomfortable.
I agree. And there's so many things that are taught that are uncomfortable. It's still very frustrating that this isn't one of those things that's included because it's very cherry picked as far as what's being taught. Mm-hmm. And I don't have kids personally, but it's much harder for people who do have kids.
I had an experience, my first parent-teacher conference when Caden was in pre-K. I learned two things right up front at this parent-teacher conference. The first was that my child had been refusing to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And the second thing I learned was that the teacher was very upset with him for telling his classmates the true story of Thanksgiving. And I think that education about these things is really going to have to start with reaching out to teachers, which is why it is so good that we have a teacher's guide that goes along with this movie.
Yeah, and there's so much going on already, and it's great to see. I feel like there's a shift underway that we're witnessing, where unfortunately, there's still a lot of resistance to teaching these truths, but we have seen a lot of folks take up the Dawnland Teacher's Guide, and now the Bounties Teacher's Guide is out and available at bountyfilm.org. And folks can dig into that and really learn about the relationship between the taking of scalps and the taking of the land and how it became the United States. Really incredible resource written by our colleague, Upstander Project Learning Director, Dr. Michie Lesser. And already the Portland Public Schools District in Maine, for example, wants to license bounty for the whole district and share it throughout the schools as they've been doing with Dawnland. And there are a lot of ways that people can help shift things. They can share these resources with teachers in their lives. You know, at the end of the day, it's individual teachers who are often making the choice. And often it's just, they just don't know. This happened to me literally last night. Fortunately, I should have listened to some great advice I had, which was check in and find out what your child's teacher is going to teach about Thanksgiving and the National Day of Mourning and about Indigenous Peoples Day, and not just those things, but about anything. And the teacher sent out an email with this book that they were going to read. My son's in first grade, my younger one is in preschool. And I read, fortunately, she sent a copy of the book, and the book was pretty horrifying in its erasure of Indigenous people and historicizing Indigenous people, sort of making it out to be that Indigenous people basically lived in the 1700s and then disappeared mysteriously with no particular explanation for why they disappeared. And I said, this book is not okay. I urge you to not use it. And I hope that you'll consider something else. And I suggested you might want to try a new book by our colleague, Christopher Newell, if you lived during the Plymouth Thanksgiving, to recontextualize things and teach the truth about what happened. And I was really grateful that they listened. They immediately wrote back and said, you make some good points about the book. We won't use it. And thanks for suggesting something else. And I think that some folks are resistant, but I think teachers are open to, it's just a lot of folks just don't know. It's not necessarily malice, but ignorance. The malice is certainly out there, but there's also a lot of ignorance. And we're used to, Malian talked about being comfortable for whom. It's also familiar. We know the stories. We are so steeped in these myths of Thanksgiving, Columbus Day, that we don't really know the true stories. And once they find out, they really do want to educate. They want to say, yeah, you know what? I do want to go to the National Day of Mourning in Plymouth on Thanksgiving or the federal holiday of Thanksgiving. And that's what I plan to do. And see Dawn there and our children together to learn the real history of what happened in this land. And even, you know, even my six-year-old looking through the book was so proud to be contributing to his class. And you can see how impressionable they are. He's looking at a picture that depicted the Pequot War. And he said, oh, I really like this page. I like the guns. And I was explained what happened, and that a lot of people died and it was really horrible. And a minute later he said, oh, daddy, I don't like this page. I like this other page where they're fishing. I don't like war. And they're so persuadable at that age. And so if we just tell them the truth, they're open to it. They want to learn the truth about what happened, and they deserve it.
What does it mean to you to be able to tell this story?
So what it means to tell this story, something that really struck me that maybe didn't when we first made it, but watching it back, is how lucky I feel for these Penobscot families to be sitting there with all of our children. You know, that was a big deal for me, you know, thinking about this era of the bounties and the, you know, state-sponsored hunting and murdering of our people. There's a thread that runs from that to the taking of land and later on really to the taking of children and these, you know, what the documentary Dawnland explores, the boarding school system and the foster care system. And that was just as genocidal and just as traumatic for our people, you know, as the things that happened in the generations before. So it felt like a whole lot of strength in that room, because here we are breaking some very oppressive and destructive cycles, raising our children in our homes, in our communities, with our culture and identity. And that was very uplifting and empowering for us. And I think it counteracted a lot of the obvious sadness and darkness that we felt as well. So that was something, you know, obviously it's a huge, important, eye-opening thing that I really felt compelled to shed light on. But for me personally, that really stuck out too.
And you just said sadness and darkness, but there's another emotion that Dawn brought up in the documentary with fear when she said, and this is one of my favorite moments of the documentary, when you said,
There was this study, they put these mice into mazes. They traumatized them by giving them an electrical shock. But before they issued the electrical shock, they sprayed orange blossom scent. What the scientists found was that those mice who had been traumatized, their kids and their grandkids and their great-grandkids all had the same traumatic response to orange blossom, even though they had never been given an electrical shock with it. The memory of being hunted like this is in our blood, and it still scares us.
And I went back and watched that again, and I saw the reaction of the child as well, and your reaction, Don. And I have two questions on this. Was that a comment that you made right there, or was that a comment that you've said previously? And also, what does that mean?
This is kind of a running theme through my life, and I'm sure it will be a running theme through my child's life. I am an activist, and my son has been with me his whole life. We started out with Occupy Wall Street when he was 18 months old, Standing Rock, resistance camps all over Indian country. The day before we filmed Bounty, we were flying in from Somisec, which is now called Texas. And there was a resistance camp there where the Ashtoganah people were resisting Trump's border wall through their ancestral burial grounds. You know, we were stopped by Border Patrol, and they insisted that they were going to search my car. And I said, no. Yeah, if you speak truth to power or you stand up to powerful forces, they will intimidate you. And that has happened several times in my work as an activist. At that time, when I was telling that to Caden, I'm sure he knew exactly what I was talking about. But there's another thing about that, you know, fear in our DNA. One of my, someone I met on Twitter sent me a book, and I'm going to read it. I haven't started it yet. But it's called Survivor Cafe, The Legacy of Trauma and the Labyrinth of Memory by Elizabeth Rosner. It was a finalist in the National Jewish Book Awards. And a lot of this epigenetic trauma is discussed in this book. We have a common thread. We're not the only people who have inherited this ancestral trauma. I think everybody has in one way or another, but some groups are especially targeted and are still targeted to this day. It was important for me to be able to draw a parallel for my son between what happened in 1755 and what continues to happen to Indigenous cultures.
It's a powerful moment when you say that, and the reaction is really what resonated with me. Getting back to the other question, have you said that line before?
No, never.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's an absolutely incredible, powerful moment. And I just want to read something from this bounty, because we've been talking about this bounty, this proclamation, and I just want to read like this, just so it's not taken lightly, just as like a term, bounty, and that meaning isn't lost. And this is what, as filmmakers, you had the children reading what the bounties are. The first one, it says, for every male Penobscot Indian above the age of 12 years that shall be taken within the time aforesaid and brought to Boston, 50 pounds. And 50 pounds, is that the one that was about $12,000?
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
And if anybody is wondering if it just stops at adult males, it doesn't. It goes right down through the line. And females are about half, and it continues down to children. And this was, I think, about double what soldiers earned in a year, or right around double what a soldier would just typically earn. So instead of fighting a long battle or fighting for an extended period of time and being committed to your government as a member of the army, you could make pretty much double with one scalp.
And it's important to say this was a real, you know, it was a lot of money. It was a real incentive for people. A lot of people, you know, there were plenty of these wealthy landowners and capitalists who were controlling a lot of the land and controlling the militias, but the everyday folks, the everyday settlers didn't necessarily have a lot of money. And so this was tremendous incentive to go out and hunt human beings. And the thing was that whether somebody was Penobscot or Mi'kmaq or Maliseet, it was about targeting Indians. And so a license to kill one particular tribe created a license to kill any native people.
Can you say that again? I need to absorb it.
There were numerous proclamations that were issued over many, many years, and they would target specific tribes by name. And sometimes they would leave specific tribes out, like they did with Penobscot Nation, where they left them out of an earlier proclamation in 1755. And then later, because the Penobscots were deemed to be now enemies of the crown, they said, okay, yeah, go ahead and add the Penobscots in. You can go ahead and target Penobscots too. But the reality is folks were just targeting native people. They didn't, you couldn't, they weren't going to go. Imagine yourself a person who's going out and hunting for the scalp of a native person. They weren't going up to people and saying, hey, what tribe are you from? Is it legal to hunt you guys? They were just killing native people and getting scalps and turning them in. There was no way to know what tribe those people were from. So the point that is, I think, really important is that it created an environment where it was a field day for hunting native people, regardless of what tribe they were from, regardless of whether or not the crown had exempted a certain tribe or other. And it created an environment to dehumanize people to this day. You can draw the through line from scalping to boarding schools, to child welfare, to the ongoing crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people today. And you can look at the history and see how we got to this point.
Exactly. I was getting to that about how it has been a through line from back then to today. And you mentioned a couple of examples. Can you talk a little bit more about those examples? Like how is there a modern day bounty? What are some modern day bounties? If you can cite some examples, because I think people would be surprised.
If you look at the fossil fuel extraction industry, there are these man camps where oil workers are set up to live while they're working. And the rates of murdered and missing Indigenous women are really high in areas where there are man camps. And not just women, young girls and Two Spirits as well. That's one example. Another example, well, look at how everybody knew Gabby Petito's story, but probably can't name one missing Native woman.
Yeah, I think when we think about today's bounty, it goes back to how visible we are and how much people value our rights and our equity. And that goes into what Don was saying about, you know, how we all knew Gabby Petito's face and her story and her family, and everybody got right to it to help find her. You know, there was no worrying about jurisdiction or whose case it was. It was just all hands on deck, as it should be. Every missing person deserves that much attention and support and respect for their life. So I think when you think about the Indigenous experience right now, still in our homelands, there's still so much of that feeling like our lives don't matter as much as they should. And up in Maine, the Penobscot Nation and the other Wabanaki tribes, we are constantly fighting through policy in the legislature and, through litigation for very simple respect and, restoration of our inherent tribal sovereignty. And this goes to our ancestral homeland, the Penobscot River. And it really, you know, there's a lot of instances in our everyday existence where, you know, we are kind of screaming for just basic equality and get ignored over and over again, even today.
And Molly and Don, feel free to rephrase this in a better way, but I also think about how, you know, these bounties were one of the initial ways that settlers tried to literally control bodies of indigenous people to take the land. And that those ideas continue today. It's control. It's always about controlling the land, controlling the resources, and not really caring what happens to indigenous people as a result of that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's another layer when you think about Indian sports mascots and these stereotypes. You know, everybody's real comfortable going to a Kansas City Chiefs game and wearing war paint and beating on a big drum. You know, those are sacred things in our culture. And it might seem, you know, silly or not a big deal to a lot of people because they're just fans having fun in a game. But there was a time when our religion and spirituality was outlawed. You know, we were persecuted for being who we are. And now we have to watch things like that go on. It also adds into the dehumanization. You know, when you're taking a group of people, turning them into an object or token for a sports game, that is also part of the big puzzle and part of why our rights are constantly trampled on.
We do a lot of coverage on a lot of different missing persons with the shows that we host, and there's nothing more frightening than the statistics of Indigenous women and girls that are reported missing just over the course of less than a decade. There's a statistic about missing Indigenous women, I believe it's around 400 that are missing just in Wyoming. And that's from, I believe, 2011 to 2020. And that's 400 just in Wyoming. I am not trying to downplay the Gabby Petito disappearance and the murder and that whole tragedy that unfolded, but It was shocking, even from like our point of view, people that covered missing persons, how much attention that got when others don't get the attention. The numbers are just staggering, it felt intentional. Did it feel like it was an intentional over the top coverage to any of you?
I will admit that I don't watch mainstream media news. So I missed a lot of the coverage. I saw it on social media.
Yeah. And we, you know, always have people who are reaching out to us with links and information for missing people. And it was nonstop. And again, I have to say, it's a tragedy what happened to her. I'm not trying to downplay that. But there was so much of it. I was starting to wonder if it, and maybe intentional isn't the right word. It just felt very deliberate. Like, look at how much we can cover this. It was salacious and exploitative, and the voices that were coming out saying, well, what about this marginalized group and this marginalized group and this marginalized group? And they were being almost accused of, like, easily triggered. I feel like I'm doing a bad job explaining this, but I see Adam's nodding, so maybe he gets what I'm saying a little bit.
I mean, maybe we've all heard of missing white woman syndrome. I think it was a term coined by Gwen Ifill, a renowned PBS journalist for a long time. And I'm a former TV news producer. And I think the argument that often got made, and I think continues to be made, is, we're covering it because it resonates with audiences. And to Malian's point earlier, well, which audiences? The audiences that I, as a non-native white producer, think are the audiences we're serving. And so it becomes a justification. Well, it gets good ratings, so therefore we should continue to cover it. But it gets good ratings with a certain segment of the population that can identify with that. But there's also plenty of other folks who say, well, what about the person missing down the street from me? What about the Indigenous woman who's been missing for years? Why is there not coverage of that? And I think that's an incredibly valid question. And it gets back to who tells the story, both in documentary spaces, podcasts, TV newsrooms. Who tells the story makes a big difference, because it shapes the story, it shapes the audience. It's a huge factor in these conversations.
And something that that I found interesting about the coverage of Gabby Petito, I think you're absolutely right. It was extremely over the top. And like I said, as it should be, people should want to find missing people. But that should extend to all people who go missing. And, there's a case of her name was Jermaine Charlo. She was a tribal member in Montana. She went missing, mother of two. She was 23. There was a lot of signs that it was likely her ex-boyfriend. He had had some convictions in the past, but they were, you know, thrown out due to technicalities. So they didn't feel right investigating him. And, you know, all these kind of excuses that we get told all the time, or why we don't get justice in these cases. She hasn't been found ever. There's a really great podcast about it called Stolen. And in the case with her, with Jermaine Charlotte, she was at a bar with a man the night she went missing. So there was a lot of speculation, like, well, why was she out drinking? She has young children. You know, why was she with this strange man that wasn't her, you know, children's father? You know, why? And this victim blaming, you know, kind of automatically happens. Other cases of missing Indigenous women are little girls. They're 15, 16 years old. They're often at these parties, and a lot of times they're stolen by sex traffickers. And there's this, well, you know, why was she going to this party? Why was she with these people? And, you know, with Gabby Petito, you know, nobody was asking why she was with this boyfriend, you know, in a very vulnerable situation, isolated, living out of a camper or whatever they were doing. You know, it was just kind of like, well, she's a free spirit and this is what they did. And she's so pretty on Instagram. We have to find her. So I think the virtue given to white women automatically and the blame given to women of color automatically is something else we really have to grapple with.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered. Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary and the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Can you tell us about the live screening you have coming up in January?
Sure. Yeah, we're going to be doing a live online screening. People can look for information about that on the Upstander Project website or at bountyfilm.org or upstanderproject.org. Live screening of Bounty with an amazing panel, including Molly and Dana and Don Neptune Adams, who are here with us, and Dr. Mishy Lesser. Really great opportunity to go beyond the film and learn about, okay, what now? What do I do? I've watched this film. Hopefully it's deeply impacted me. What do I do now going forward? So we hope folks will come out for that January 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern. I would love to have you all join us.
And do you have any plans for a longer version of this?
Molly, do you want to share anything about Margaret Moxa or anything like that?
Sure. I do hope that, you know, the Bounty film is someday kind of fleshed out and maybe made longer, we'll see. But kind of a parallel project that we started working on was telling one story of the victim of these Bounty proclamations. And her name was Margaret Moxa, and she was a Penobscot woman, mother. She had some, you know, diplomat experience, and she was a healer. She knew about traditional medicines. And she was hunted and scalped, and her and her family, including her infant son, were all turned in for a bounty by a man named Captain James Cargill. And Adam and Mishy had kind of discovered in their research this story, and we talked about a way to kind of bring this to life in a way that might complement the work around Bounty and the Teacher's Guide. So I wrote a play kind of around the life of Margaret Moxa, and also diving into some, you know, issues in the future. It kind of jumps around in time and tells the story from a few different perspectives. And from the idea of a play, we've kind of expanded it to maybe a short film based on the script that I've written. So we're still kind of working all that through, but it's a really exciting arm of the Bounty Project that I'm super happy to be involved with.
That's very interesting. Yeah, definitely keep us updated on that project, please.
And I just have a couple more questions. One of them is just about the Upstanding project. What can you tell us a little bit about that? How did that get started?
Sure. Yeah. So the Upstander project started in 2009 with a film called Coexist about forced reconciliation in Rwanda after the genocide there. And then 2013, we heard about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which ended up being the centerpiece of Dawnland. And the whole point of our work is to teach about decolonization and encourage upstanding, especially about injustice, social injustice, through documentary films and learning resources. So the pairing of those things is really essential, making sure that it's not just watching the film, but it's also digging into the issues behind the films and bring those to classrooms. And since then, we've made Dawnland, as well as First Light and Dear Georgina, which are short films related to Dawnland, which are free to watch on the Upstander Project website, upstanderproject.org. And we do our flagship program, which is the Upstander Academy, where we have a 6-day professional development workshop for teachers typically in Boston in the summertime. And we welcome folks from all over the country, but we often have folks from Greater Boston, a lot of folks from Maine due to the topics of our films. to really go deep learning about the films and the issues and how to teach them. Because one of the biggest things that we encounter is, the teaching workforce is disproportionately white. And also a lot of folks feel uncomfortable, nervous, or scared to teach about Indigenous issues. And we are trying to help those teachers, all teachers, become more comfortable teaching about these things and be more comfortable admitting what they don't know and learning together with their students so that they can understand that Indigenous history is U.S. history and begin teaching that not just in electives, but in every way they can bring those stories into their classroom, stories like what you see in Bounty and Dawnland.
And tell us a little bit about Dawnland.
The Maine Wabanaki Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission began in 2013, and it was a time for, documenting the stories and statements of people who had been involved in the taking of Native children from their homes and communities. Not just Native children, Native people telling their stories, but also child welfare workers, government agencies, and all that. I gave a public statement. I was reluctant to do it. I knew I would be opening a huge can of worms of, trauma that I hadn't processed yet. And I think a lot of us will avoid doing these things, avoid, diving into difficult things like that because, well, who wouldn't? Ben and Adam approached me about being in the movie Dawnland. They came to my college and to my home in Bangor, and we had a nice discussion. I really didn't want to be in the movie. I wasn't ready to be that visible, but it is a really beautiful movie. If anybody out there has not seen it, I highly recommend it.
Thank you. Just that folks can watch Dawnland through the end of November on the PBS website and the PBS video apps, and otherwise look for it at dawnland.org.
I'm curious if it helped, Don, because you said that you weren't ready to contribute to it, to be in it. Did it end up helping you? Were you happy that you did it?
Yes, I was very happy that I did it. After the movie came out and after the report came out, the findings, I was at the University of Maine and I had to do a summer project for the capstone for my Indigenous cultures class, and I figured I would do it on the report that came out. So as I was reading this 90-page report, I was reading the words of other people who had given statements, especially Denise Altivater, reading her words and knowing that we went through the same things. I went into a tailspin. After I gave my statement, I had felt better. It felt like a load off my shoulders, and I thought I was done. But it has been a long, 6 years now? Of unpacking this stuff and processing it and dealing with it, usually right on a public stage. When Adam asked if I wanted to do Dawnland screenings, that was another thing I was reluctant to do, but I did it because I wanted things to change. I didn't want other Native children to have to go through the same thing. So I agreed, to do these screenings and these panel discussions. And yeah, it was kind of like being pushed into the pool without knowing how to swim, but it has definitely been helpful. I've made a lot of progress in my healing journey.
Yeah, that's really good to hear, because only knowing you through the documentary and on this interview, it's evident that what you have to say is super important for people to hear. And it's good to hear that working through it by doing these projects is therapeutic and is helpful.
Thank you for your kind words.
Does anyone have anything else they'd like to add to the conversation?
I don't think I have too much to add. I just, you know, in all of these interviews, I've been talking about just how much pride I feel in the process and the outcome. And I just, you know, really want to thank the filmmakers and Upstander Academy for holding so much sacred space for the families as we did this work. And I definitely have a special place in my heart for the families and the kids and parents that took part from Penobscot Nation.
I would just like to send out my appreciation for anybody who is watching this film and, you know, going through a learning process. I'd also like to ask everyone to be gentle with themselves. They might feel, you know, shame or blame for things that their ancestors might have done. And it's a really uncomfortable process to go through, to see the actual history and to know the truth and to come to terms with it. I want you to know that I don't want you to feel responsible. What I would like you to do is to dismantle the systems that your ancestors made and that you still benefit from. One of the things my son said while we were filming some of the video that goes with the Bounty Media ecosystem at bountyfilms.org, one of the things he said was, "We want you to stand in solidarity with us." And I have to amplify his words every chance I get. Once you know the truth, once you know the truth of what happened, it's easier for you to form kinship connection with us and to stand in solidarity with us when we ask.
And there's so much that we can do. I think sometimes we see folks maybe feel a little bit paralyzed of, oh, it's so terrible. I can't believe that my ancestors did these horrible things, or I can't believe that these horrible things were done by settlers to indigenous people. And people maybe get a little stuck. And we want to encourage people, it's okay to feel that way. And then we need to move through that and find ways to take action. And so we have a lot of resources for folks to do that. You know, as we're recording this during Thanksgiving week, folks can watch Dawnland through the end of November on the PBS website or PBS apps, and also bountyfilm.org. You can watch the Bounty film. You can read the teacher's guide. We hope that folks will engage with this over the holiday weekend. Watch it with your relatives. And on the Upstander Project website at upstanderproject.org/land, we have a tremendous list of resources that you can dig into: films, books, podcasts, so many things that people can engage with. If you follow all the different lists that we have there, you could keep yourself busy for years. So there's no excuse to not learn more now that you're interested in this. We hope people will find whatever makes sense for them to learn more. Do a land acknowledgement at your Thanksgiving table if that's the way that you celebrate the federal holiday. Do it with your family at the end of the year and acknowledge whose land you're on, and share a little bit of history, whatever you can learn about the folks that that are in the place where you are. And then move beyond land acknowledgments with some of those resources at the Upstander Project website.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought all this up. And one additional piece of advice I would give is to take your time doing it, because you I think one of the hurdles is that it feels overwhelming to get past the guilt and the shame of the whole thing, and to then dig into the history of it. It does feel a bit overwhelming, but take your time, because it's always going to be there. And your resources are so vast, and they'll always be there as well. And I love the idea of doing a land acknowledgement. In, you know, a lot of families have traditions to go around the table and just say what they're thankful for. Say you're thankful for that, you know, not exactly. I think that might be a good alternative, at least at our table this year. And it's interesting, and there's no question here, I just want to bring it up, that Dawn brought up the shame and the awkwardness to get through a conversation or to start the conversation. I actually have a note written down, address shame issue, and I wasn't going to do it. And then it was brought up and I circled it. And I'm like, well, there it is right there. Case in point, like the purpose of this interview was to talk about these things. And I was ready to wrap it up and say, you know, this has been great without actually addressing it. So even in this position where I was prepared, I wasn't prepared.
I'd like to take Adam's statement one step further. If you listeners out there have more land and resources than you need, don't just acknowledge it, give it back. Under this oppressive capitalist system, land and resources and money are power. And if you have more than you need, give it back.
How would that's great. How would you do that?
You can do some research and find out whose land you're actually on. Then contact the tribe and say, hey, I have some of your land. I'd like to give it back.
I asked because it is that easy, because that is about as easy as it gets. You contact the appropriate people and you work out the arrangement. And I'm glad that we brought that up as well, because, again, it is a matter of phone call, couple emails, working it out.
And hopefully it's great to see that it's happening in a lot of places. And a lot of times landowners are being compensated by land trusts and complicated financial deals. But there's a lot of irony to that when you consider that the land was stolen and the landowners are getting paid to give back stolen property. So we hope that folks will simply give it back without compensation, because in fact, they should be giving it back and paying the original stewards of the land for squatting on the land for so long.